So today I'm going to tell you a little bit about massive star oscillations. This is not a review talk, so I'm going to leave out a lot of stuff. I'm also probably going to slander a few people. I'm going to say wrong things, and when you hear me say something wrong, please shout out and correct me. Also, if I'm unclear, please stop me and get me to explain. This is a pedagogical talk, so the idea is that perhaps you learn a little thing about something about stellar oscillations, but I'm really expecting to be interrupted in a dialogue to spring up from this, rather than me to stand up here, deliver a talk for 50 minutes, and then all go our separate ways. The sort of starting point for talking about massive star oscillations is to talk about periodically variable massive stars. In fact, the real starting point is to define what we mean by a massive star. So this is a massive stars program. What is a massive star? Okay, so is a two-solar mass star a massive star? Hands up. Okay, how about five and above? How about nine? Okay, so... You want me to go higher? 20? 15?
Yes.
Okay, so we can't even agree on what a massive star is, so I declare the program over. So for me today, I'm defining a massive star as something that has an O and B spectral type on the main sequence. Now, what that means to me is that the atmospheric and interior physics is kind of the same. We've got a convective core, a radiative envelope. Electron scattering is the dominant opacity source in the stellar surface layers, and it's probably got a radiation-driven wind, and it probably rotates lots, hasn't got a magnetic field. Let's pretend that 7% of massive stars aren't magnetic. In fact, let's pretend none of them are. For a lot of you, the important thing is whether it goes bang at the end of its life. And nine solar masses may be the cutoff for that, or if you're interested in other sorts of things, it may have to be more massive. If you want to get a black hole out of it, it may have to be even more massive. So we define the word massive star really in the context of what we're interested in. And for me, I'm kind of boring. I like main sequence stars because we can't even understand those. So the more fancy stuff is way off in the, I haven't even got a clue, sort of land. And when we're thinking about main sequence stars, stars with OB spectral types on the main sequence, they've all got similar interior physics, and that's why I focus on them. So, there are two main types of variable massive star, beta Cephei stars, which are O and early B spectral types. These show periodic variations, typically of a couple of hours. And these stars, they're variable because they have excited P modes. These are standing acoustic waves. Down towards later spectral types, lower masses, are the slowly pulsating B stars or SPB stars. Don't confuse them with the SDB stars, completely different class. These are periods of many hours up to a few days, makes them really inconvenient to study from the ground, but conversely, if you put something up in space, you can study the hell out of it for months and months, and you can do some really great science. These stars have G modes, which are standing internal gravity waves. Gravity waves are not gravitational waves. LIGO has completely stunk up Google search results. If you type in gravity waves, it gives you LIGO stuff. So the field of internal gravity waves lies in tatters because of this damn LIGO result. So there are some other types of variable massive star pulsating blue supergiants like Rigel, and there are claims of periodic variability in some Wolf-Rayet stars, and then there are... there's basically a whole menagerie of weird stuff, but these are the two main classes. So let's talk about...
Rich, what about post-main sequence? Are there any clear stellar seismology of post-main sequence massive stars?
There are some pulsating massive stars, probably supergiants, that are beyond the terminal age main sequence and still seem to show periodic variations. We think that's an extension of these instability strips. You can actually still get the... you'll see, I'll show some instability strips in a moment. And there are classical Cepheids, but classical Cepheids are way across to the red. And, by that time, they've disappeared from my vision. I can only see the left-hand side of the HR diagram.
What about kind of in supergiant stochastically excited modes like in the sun? Do we see any evidence for that?
There have been some claims that stochastically excited modes have been seen. In fact, I've got a couple of slides on stochastic modes, but in my eyes, the jury's still out on that. There are theoretical grounds for believing that we've seen them, but I don't think there's been a slam dunk demonstration yet. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about some physics. Waves and stars. So stars are self-gravitating gaseous spheres. That's how you explain a star to a physicist. And because they're gases, they have a restoring force of pressure that brings displaced fluid elements back into its equilibrium position. Because that fluid element has inertia, it'll overshoot its equilibrium position and it'll oscillate. So whenever we've got a restoring force and inertia, we get an oscillation. For gas pressure, it's the restoring force, the type of oscillation we get, or the type of wave motion is acoustic waves. And then in a star, because of the gravitational stratification, there's an additional type of wave, gravity waves, as I mentioned, not LIGO. These gravity waves, the restoring force is not gas pressure per se, it's a sort of gas pressure, it's actually buoyancy that comes from the gravitational stratification. So the dispersion relation for acoustic waves just looks like a nice non-dispersive relation. Frequency squared equals some sound speed squared times the wave number squared. We don't care about what direction the waves are going in. All we care about is their wave number. Gravity waves, the dispersion relation is rather different. Frequency squared goes as the ratio of the horizontal wave number squared over the total wave number squared. So here's the wave number decomposed into horizontal, sort of that's the direction perpendicular to gravity, and radial, that's the gravitational direction. So the frequency of gravity waves depends not on the magnitude of their wave vector, but the direction of the wave vector. And the overall scaling is set by the Brunk-Weissler frequency. Weissler was the motley crew of meteorologists. Some of you will laugh at that, some of you will not get that at all. It's an age thing. The Brunk-Weissler frequency is the buoyancy frequency. If I take a fluid element and displace it a small amount vertically in a gravitationally, Stephen's just got it, in a gravitationally stratified medium, it'll oscillate up and down with the Brunk-Weissler frequency. So gravity waves, the frequency of a gravity wave depends only on the direction of the gravity wave and the Brunk-Weissler frequency. It doesn't depend on the magnitude of the wave vector. So these are basic types of wave motion. However, the slightly more to stellar oscillations than just waves, we have to apply boundary conditions. If we think of waves on a stretched string, an infinite string can support waves of any frequency and any wave number, but a finite length string that's clamped at both ends, oscillations on that string, in order to be standing waves, have to satisfy boundary conditions. And those boundary conditions essentially place restrictions on what frequencies are allowed, so the eigenfrequencies of the system. So let's see what the boundary conditions look like in the case of a star. When we apply boundary conditions in the angular directions, these are periodic boundary conditions, and these lead to angular eigenfunctions that are just the familiar spherical harmonics. That's not going to play for me now, isn't it? There we go. So the reason why we end up with spherical harmonics when we're doing stars, and we end up with spherical harmonics when we're doing quantum mechanics for, let's say, a hydrogen atom, is that we're solving a wave equation in spherical symmetry. So there's a nice physical correspondence between the two. So spherical harmonics are the product between an associated Legendre polynomial and an exponential function, and they're characterized by a pair of quantum numbers, L, the harmonic degree, and M, the azimuthal order. These are an example of three different spherical harmonics. So these are the sorts of oscillations we see in stars. However, the amplitude has been greatly exaggerated. The stars aren't really quite this distorted. So the permissible horizontal wave numbers of waves and stars actually depends, so KH, depends on the harmonic degree L by this expression here. So this is the same L times L plus 1 that we see when we're thinking about the angular momentum of, let's say, a hydrogen atom. So a lot of analogies there. So as well as applying angular boundary conditions, we have to apply boundary conditions in the radial direction. So when we're doing waves on a stretched string, the condition that the string is clamped at both ends leads to a quantization condition that the wave number, or 2 pi over the wavelength, times the length of the string, must be an integer number n times pi, and n is a sort of mode number or mode index. So here is the fundamental mode with the lowest frequency, first overtone, second overtone, and so on. If we do the same for a star, we can kind of wave our hands and squint a little bit and say, well, yeah, let's use the same expression, except the radial wave number actually depends on position in the star. So rather than writing k times l, I'm going to do the integral of k over the radius of the star, but I'm still going to set that equal to n pi. And in fact, this does a good zeroth order job of encapsulating what the boundary conditions or the quantization conditions look like for oscillations in a star. And here's a plot of a set of radial eigenfunctions as a function of position in the star for an n equals 3 polytrope. And here I've got the fundamental mode, which is in blue, the first overtone, which is in sort of pinky purple, and the second overtone, which is in blue-green. And you can see that as we go up by one radial order, the number of nodes in the radial eigenfunction goes up by one. So again, there's a really strong analogy with just simple waves on a string, and that's how I like to think about these systems. You'll notice that the eigenfunctions aren't actually zero at either boundary, as they are in the stretched string case, but that's just details. All that really matters is our quantization relation. So we can take our relations for that tell us how the wave number is quantized by the boundary conditions. So there's the angular boundary conditions and the radial boundary conditions. We can combine those with the dispersion relation for, let's say, gravity modes. You can do a similar exercise for P modes, but this is going to be for G modes. You can combine these expressions together, and you can figure out an expression for the periods of modes with a given n, the radial order, so that's the number of nodes in the radial eigenfunctions, the L, the harmonic degree, and M, the azimuthal order. The periods of these G modes don't depend at all on M, they just depend on N and L, and then there's this sort of structure term which encapsulates some sort of average over the star of the buoyancy frequency. So based on this expression, we expect a series of modes that have the same L, but N increasing by one each time, to have a uniform separation in period. And that period separation will tell us something about the average buoyancy frequency throughout the star. And this is the fundamental sort of principle of astroseismology. Or you expect there to be some kind of structure in the frequencies or periods of modes that you observe in the star. If you observe a long sequence of modes that have one quantum number fixed and another quantum number incrementing by one, you observe this regular series, and you use your understanding of what you expect that series to look like to place constraints on the star's properties. Now, in reality, things are a little bit more complicated than this and a little bit cleverer, but this is the basic principle for how astroseismology works. This is a sort of zeroth order expression for the periods, and then we can take into account first order and second order corrections that allow us to say even more about the star structure. So to give an example of this expression in action.
Now, back question on the previous one. So R sub C is the core radius?
Mm-hmm.
So basically the statement is then that the period just depends on the envelope structure. The core doesn't couple into.
That's right. And the reason is that G modes don't penetrate into the core. So when people talk about using G modes to probe the core of massive stars, what they really mean is the core boundary. So the molecular weight gradient zone that has arisen from partially burnt material. The G modes can't really go inside the core because it's convective. Convection is basically unstable G modes.
And from a know-nothing computer scientist, we'll have to question about your boundary conditions.
Uh-huh.
Is that what values of R do those apply to?
What values of R? What do you mean?
They're written for a little r, which means it's R from what? RC to R? Does that hold everywhere? Does that only hold at R equals RC? Boundary conditions. No, in between. Boundary conditions.
That
circular and radial boundary conditions. What are the R? The R there. And also, even the one down there, what are the bounds of that integral?
That integral goes over the whole star, but the reason why I've truncated it at our core here is that the buoyancy frequency is effectively zero in the core because the core is undergoing efficient convection.
And what's the upper bound for I'm still on radial boundary conditions.
The upper bound is the stellar surface.
So that is really not applying internally to the star, it's just at the
Well, it's an integral over the whole. That integral is over the whole star.
But it really is a boundary condition in that sense. So is that also true then for the angular boundary conditions? Those are only applying for R equals RC?
No. That applies throughout the. This applies throughout the whole star. At any point in the star, you evaluate KH using this expression. It's not written in the form of a boundary condition. It's more a quantization condition.
No, I understand.
Okay. So it tells you that no matter what KR does in this star, if you integrate it throughout the star, it should be equal to n times pi.
But that's one constraint, and the other one is constraints that apply everywhere.
And this is a constraint that applies everywhere. I should add that you won't find this in any book, because this is, you know, this is really a heuristic. You can actually rigorously derive a slightly more complicated expression that does a sort of WKBJ style analysis and do things properly. That's why I haven't put limits on that integral, because, you know, that's kind of a cartoon equation.
Yep.
Okay, don't read too much into it. Okay, so let's see period spacing in action. Okay, so that's not going to be it. This is a 4.21 stellar mass model for an SPD star. It's about two-thirds of the way through its main sequence evolution. Actually, no, sorry, I lie. This star is actually on the zero-age main sequence right now. Because I know this because this is a plot of the hydrogen mass fraction as a function of radius in the core region, fractional radius, and you can see that x is 0.7, so this star is unburned. This is a plot of the period spacing between consecutive dipole modes as a function of the radial order of those modes. Okay, and you can see, apart from at the small n case, the period spacing is pretty damn constant. So the expression that I showed you kind of works. Okay, now let's see what happens when the star evolves. So, I'm actually going to run this from the laptop because I want to be able to stop it. Okay, so as the star evolves, we start to see departures from our regular period spacing, but the departures have a regularity to them. So you can see that the period spacing has a peak about every maybe 10 radial orders and a minimum about every 10 radial orders. There's a regular structure in the period spacing. On average, the period spacing is what we would expect, that's what's shown by the dotted line, from just using the asymptotic formula. These departures from the period spacing are occurring because as the star burns hydrogen in its core, so we can see the hydrogen mass fractions going down, we end up with this molecular weight gradient zone at the core boundary, and this leads to a sharp peak in the Brunt-Weissler frequency. And it's that sharp peak in the Brunt-Weissler frequency that introduces this regular modulation in the period spacing. As the star evolves even more, you will see that the separation between consecutive peaks in this pattern gets smaller as the peak in the buoyancy frequency gets larger and broader. So we can actually use this regular modulation of the period spacing to place constraints on how evolved the star is. So this is actually doing real astroseismology now. So let me run this the model a little bit more. And there comes a point where we're really no longer resolving. We're kind of under, the modes are kind of undersampling the pattern. So this star is now at, 0.3 central hydrogen abundance, and its period spacing is very, very ragged. So this is definitely an evolved star, and it's really this huge feature in the buoyancy frequency caused by this gradient in the hydrogen mass fraction. It's actually a gradient in the molecular weight that causes this. So we can, for SPB stars, we can figure out their age by looking for regular modulations in the period space. That's pretty cool. Okay, so...
Sorry, has that been detected?
Yes.
And, I mean, the exact structure of that region depends on overshooting, other mixing.
It does!
So does it actually tell you the age, or does it tell you...
When you start playing around with overshooting, the visibility of the modulation changes as you go to higher radial orders. So you can actually use that to test out different models of overshoot, for instance, and say which one seems to fit the observations better.
So how many How many, how well sampled observationally is that?
I'll show you some pictures later on. I'm actually just going to change gears for a little bit, talk about why we see these oscillations. So in the sun, the oscillations we see are stochastically excited by banging going on at the base of the convection zone. In massive stars, at least for Beta Cephei and SBB stars, the oscillations are excited by a genuine instability, a heat engine, if you like. So Eddington, when thinking about the cause of excitation of pulsations in Cepheids, classical Cepheids, pointed out that if you add heat to the working material, the star, when it's hot and remove heat when it's cold, you're going to do a net amount of work per cycle, and this is exactly how a heat engine works. So Eddington also pointed out that the important thing to get this heat engine working was to create a valve that adds the heat at the right moment and removes it at the right moment, and that opacity could serve as this valve. Now, in classical Cepheids, the opacity that serves as the valve is the hydrogen and helium ionization opacity. For massive stars, there's actually a peak in the opacity at around 200,000 Kelvin due to same K-shell iron and nickel transitions, which are spin orbit split. There's millions of transitions created by or associated with iron and nickel that lead to this prominent peak known as the iron bump or the Z bump in the opacity. So this is a plot of Rosalind mean opacity as a function of log temperature and log density divided by T blah. This is the term you get when you're considering Cramer's opacities, I think. So this is how opal opacity tables tend to be laid out. The solid lines show the path through parameter space sampled by stars of a number of different masses. And you can see that all of these stars go over a prominent bump in or peak in the opacity called the Z bump. The more massive stars don't actually get out to sample the ridges caused by hydrogen and helium ionization. They're too hot.
This is zero age main sequence.
I think this is probably zero age main sequence models, yeah. Yeah, there we go. See? So it's this iron opacity peak, which only became known about in the 90s when OPAL published new opacity tables and the Opacity Project published new tables. It was only with the advent of these new opacities that we actually knew or learned what causes Beta Cephei and slowly pulsating B star phenomena. So based on these opacity data, we can actually calculate from sort of first principles instability strips, regions of the HR diagram where stars are unstable to one or more P modes or G modes driven by the opacity mechanism associated with the iron bump. So these are a set of massive star instability strips for Beta Cephei stars shown in orange and SBB stars shown in blue. This is a plot from the MESA 3 paper, Bill's paper. And basically, we just ran a huge number of models covering the main sequence and post-main sequence up at the higher masses, and then saw whether each of those models was unstable to one or more mode. And these panels show different harmonic degrees. So L equals zero are the radial modes. These are dipole modes, quadrupole modes, and octopole modes. And in answer to, I think, Elliot's question about post-main sequence? You can see that the Beta Cephei strip extends beyond the end of the main sequence, as does there's kind of a narrow sliver of the SBB strip that actually creeps up towards higher masses and then extends into the post-main sequence. And we think this blue extension is what explains pulsating super blue supergiants.
Does the strip change with metallicity?
Yes, it does. Obviously, if the metals go away, there's no strip at all. It gets smaller as you turn down the metallicity. The strip also changes when you tweak other parameters like overshoot. Not by a huge amount. Metallicity is probably one of the most important factors.
So, but it just shifts, not the shape.
It gets smaller as you turn down the metallicity, because eventually it has to disappear. These fingers that we see in the strip are something we've never seen before. You'll never see those in the real world because real stars have things like rotation and other factors which will tend to kind of blur the boundaries of the sort of observational instability strip. But it was just nice to actually run a set of models with sufficient density in HR diagram space to sort of bring out fun features like that. Okay, so this is a confrontation between theory and observations. where we expect the instability strips to be and where we actually see pulsating massive stars, developed by Pamyatnik. Down here we have the SBB strip. Here is the high mass extension of the SBB strip, but there's no real post-main sequence SBB strip because back then Pamyatnik didn't know about that. We see the SBB stars are nicely confined to the SBB strip, and the Beta Cephei stars seem to be more or less confined to the Beta Cephei strip, although there are some stars that seem to be too young to actually be unstable. There's been some recent work by Eason Muraveji suggesting that we still haven't got the opacities quite right for iron, and if we put in some updated opacity measurements from lab experiments into our codes, we can actually make the Beta Cephei strip come down to the zero-age main sequence and agree with the observations.
That's higher opacities?
Yes. So as we go up to higher masses, so all of the SBB stuff is now down here. This is a plot by Sayo trying to summarize what we know about the high mass part of the HR diagram. And, you know, here be dragons. We really haven't got a fucking clue what's going on out there. There are observations of variable stars all over the place. There are these very, very sort of ragged boundaries. So the dashed line is the Beta Cephei instability strip, but then it combines kind of over with the classical instability strip. These are unstable stars that seem to have unstable convective modes. I think the dashed line might be dynamically unstable stars, and it kind of looks like the Humphreys-Davidson limit, hey? And then this is the solid lines here are the post-main sequence G-mode pulsators, and then the dot dashed lines are stars that are unstable to strange modes. Strange modes are a kind of weird radiation hydro instability that occurs in very massive stars, and they're still relatively poorly understood. So there's a whole menagerie of weird instabilities that can happen in the upper part of the main sequence. And we still haven't fully established which of them are real and which of them are numerical, which of them might be important for triggering mass loss and explaining extreme variability, and which ones might not be important. And also, our ability to actually do modeling up in this upper part of the HR diagram is still quite raw. And that's why these boundaries are kind of ragged and uncertain. So this is still a part of the HR diagram that really needs to be explored properly. It's still very much terra incognita.
Which aspect of the modeling is
it? Things like how much of a sin are we committing when we stop our high-mass models from pulling themselves apart? Is that going to cause problems to come out elsewhere? When you do squirrely things with models, pulsation codes do squirrely squared things.
That was the distinction I was trying to make.
Yeah.
When you say it's a problem with models, it's the input of the pulsation code, not a problem in the modeling in the pulsation code.
Well, there's also challenges in the modeling of the pulsation code, because there's...
my fault?
It's both of our faults, Bill.
Your fault too, good.
So your models are crap and my code is crap.
Perfect. Okay.
So up here...
I always believed one of those.
These stars have very, very strong radiation-driven winds, and we really don't have a nice idea of how those winds actually interact dynamically with the pulsation. We can explore how the winds change the stellar structure and how that changes the oscillations, but we don't actually understand the dynamical effect, because really we shouldn't be putting on a standard reflecting, let's say, vacuum boundary condition at the stellar surface when it's got a radiation-driven wind. We've got to do better than that. But we really don't know how. And these pulsations may be important for seeding structure in the winds that I'm sure Staniwocki's going to tell us about at some point during the program. A lot of these pulsating B supergiants show periodic or episodic wind structures that are possibly linked to pulsation in the star's atmosphere, but we really don't have a comprehensive theory for modeling that.
It's just that, I mean, the other wild card is inflation.
Envelope inflation, yeah. And there's rotation, of course, and everything else. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about stochastic excitation of modes. So the idea here is that convective motions, whether in the core of the star, I'm thinking about main sequence stars again here, but the convection could be in, let's say, a burning shell if the star has evolved off the main sequence. On main sequence stars, again, there's convection in the iron bump zone. And these convection zones can, in principle, stochastically excited mode, stochastically excite mode. So Coralie Niner claimed that, and her team claimed that they'd seen stochastically excited modes in the rapidly rotating BE star HD blah blah. And the reason why I've highlighted rapidly rotating is that their analysis that, or their conclusion that this star shows stochastic modes was only based on the fact that it falls outside the instability strips that I've shown you on previous slides. And those argue with me, come on.
You look at the data, I mean, it's clearly very variable above any position of the instrument of Corot. And if you look at the power spectrum, it's completely flat. There's absolutely nothing standing out.
No?
No.
But when we see stochastically excited modes in other stars, we do see stuff in the power spectrum. And the reason why we partly know that we're seeing stochastically excited modes is that the lines are broader than they would be if they were persistent modes that didn't die away and then get re-excited at some randomized phase. So until someone actually observes a mode that's persistent but has a broad line which suggesting it's coming and going and coming and going, I'm hesitant to conclude that we're seeing stochastically excited modes.
Yeah, but something in the variability has a very stochastic nature.
Okay. So I will agree that this star perhaps is a weird case, but I think saying it's stochastically excited modes is kind of a God of the Gaps argument. That's, you know, okay, it's not what we understand, so it must be stochastic. Or it must be what we understand to be stochastic excitation by convection. So I'm kind of somewhat skeptical of the focus on stochastic excitation. I'm not sure we've seen it yet, but I certainly think it could be happening. We just need to be a bit more careful. So Josh Yodi with Elliott showed that if modes are excited at the core boundary just by convective motions, then we should be able to see some signature of these modes on the surface. And this is unlike the Sun. We don't see G modes on the surface of the Sun, because the subsurface convection zone is a big evanescent zone to those G-modes, and their amplitudes decay exponentially, and we just get nothing at the surface. Whereas for massive stars, because we've got this radiative envelope, if G-modes are being excited at the core boundary, we can expect to see some sort of photometric variability at the surface, albeit at low amplitudes. So Connie Arts and Tammy Rogers have done some work on stochastic excitation at the core boundary and actually doing numerical simulations of G-modes excited at the core boundary. And they argue that the macro-turbulent broadening, that's such a pervasive feature of OB star spectra, is a signature of stochastic mode excitation. So here's another piece of evidence that's perhaps pointing towards stochastic modes being in almost all stars, all massive stars. But like I say, I'm still unconvinced, but willing to be convinced.
I would also add that to this slide that, you know, this star also has subsurface convective regions that can also excite stochastic.
The iron bump zone, yeah?
Yeah. So
that's another site for stochastic excitation. I'm sure it'll come up in the... when we discuss magnetic fields, but there's one star, I think, blah, 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 dash 2. You remember dash 2, Stan?
NGC 1624 dash 2.
That's the one. Okay, so this star shows no macroturbulent broadening, and it's got a field that's strong enough to inhibit motions in the iron bump convection zone. So that is really a smoking gun for the turbulent broadening actually being rooted in the iron bump convection zone, but I'm sure we'll discuss that when we focus on fields. Okay, so how do we do astroseismology of massive stars? There's the time.
Do massive stars, as they evolve off the main sequence, develop mixed modes? Lower mass red giants?
Not really. It's the mixed modes really exist, I think, because of the huge dichotomy between this sort of white dwarf core and a great big puffy envelope.
Okay, but you're saying even when they evolve to become supergiants?
They can have mixed modes.
Okay.
They haven't been observed.
Have they been
predicted? Yes.
Okay. What is mixed mode?
A mixed mode is a star that in one part of the star behaves like a P mode, but in another part of the star behaves like a G mode. It's basically when you at a given frequency, one or more parts of the star behave like a mode trapping cavity. And if one mode trapping cavity, in that cavity, the local mode frequency is less than the Brunt-Weissler frequency and the Lamb frequency, the mode will there behave like a G mode, and if it's higher than both of those critical frequencies, it'll behave like a P mode.
So you can go from one layer to another, and it excites the goes from which one to which, from P to G?
And vice versa. I mean, remember, these are standing waves, so it's more like you have two coupled oscillators. One oscillator is kind of a P mode oscillator, and one's a G mode oscillator. And there's an evanescent region between. There has to be an evanescent region.
To leak through.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can have mixed modes with polytropes. There's nothing physically special about them. But to... I guess the real question is whether they're going to be excited and whether they're going to be visible and whether they're going to tell you something interesting. In Red Giants, it turned out the answer to those questions was yes. I don't know whether the answer to those questions is yes for Red Supergiants.
Something doesn't click in my head. Probably you said, but so why the more massive stars have standing wave acoustic waves and less massive stars have G waves?
Oh, was no. So G modes are just standing internal gravity waves. These are all standing modes. Oh, okay. So both types of star support both G modes and P modes. But in the more massive stars, P modes tend to be excited because they have shorter time scales. And in the less massive stars, G modes are excited, which have longer time scales. The reason for the time scale difference is down to the stellar effective temperature. As you go to more massive stars, the stellar effective temperature gets higher, which means the iron bump excitation zone moves closer to the stellar surface. When it's closer to the stellar surface, the thermal time scale is shorter there, which means it's favorable for exciting shorter period modes. Okay? Okay, so in the 20th century, the real challenge with massive star oscillations was to figure out why they oscillated in the first place. So there's a history of observing oscillating massive stars going back through the whole of the 20th century, but it was only in the early to mid-90s that we actually figured out why they oscillate, and it's because of this iron bump opacity mechanism. In a sense, the tardiness of these opacity data, the fact that we had to wait decades for them, was actually a big promoter of a diversity of ideas and hypothesizing how they might. I mean, there was some really great fundamental stuff done in the 70s and 80s that was both brilliant and wrong, but nevertheless still contains a lot of really interesting ideas that still could be quite important.
It's also important to say, I mean, I don't remember the author, but there was, out of all those papers, there was one that pointed to the need.
Oh, there are none.
Higher iron opacity.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think Stallingworth was banging that drum, and so people weren't completely surprised when the new opacity data came out, and there was this extra opacity bump, and suddenly things started pulsating. Nevertheless, in the lead up to that, there was really a huge diversity of weird and wacky ideas, and it was really interesting. Okay, so in the 21st century, the challenge is rather different. It's actually to use these oscillations to do astroseismology. So the word astroseismology has probably been used in vain on grants for 20 years now, and it's only really in the last 5 years that hasn't been probably overselling the idea. So astroseismology is using observations of stellar oscillations to place constraints on the stellar structure. At the basic level, we hope to get stellar parameters out, like mass, radius, luminosity maybe, age. But when we do things in detail, we hope to get real constraints on what's going on in the internal structure of the star and actually perhaps learn something about which physical prescription is correct, let's say for overshoot, and which might be not so correct. So to do this astroseismology, we need to first detect a large number of modes, and secondly, we need to find regularities in the mode frequencies or mode periods, which will allow us to infer what our quantum numbers L and M are without having to do sort of expensive spectroscopic follow-up to actually do mode identification based on Doppler imaging, which is really a laborious way of doing things. What's changed in recent years is Kepler, and before it to some extent, Most and Corot. So we all know about Kepler. Kepler observed only around 50 main sequence B stars, so a tiny fraction of the total number of stars surveyed. But in these stars, in the Kepler light curves for these stars, the ones that are oscillating, we've identified 15 of these stars as SBB stars, and they show hundreds and hundreds of modes that are completely invisible from the ground. Some of these stars will be classified as non-variable from the ground, or some will be classified as monomode pulsators. And in fact, we see hundreds of modes, and we can identify regular sequences in these modes. So we can actually do astroseismology. So this is a lovely plot from a paper by Peter Pavich, showing five different SBB stars with a light curve. These are Kepler light curves, and then the power spectrum. And they've been ranked in order of increasing frequency at which the power spectrum's got the most power. So these are the sort of data we're working with. In some of the stars, you can see that the variation appears to be quasi-periodic, like this star. In other stars, it appears to be pretty much random, but of course it's not random at all. That's just hundreds and hundreds of pulsation modes beating against each other. So I'm going to focus on this star in a little bit more detail because it's got some really interesting stuff in its light curve. So here's the light curve for this star. I'm calling it Alice because it's a long name. I've turned the light curve on its side so time runs like this. And again, we can see this beating at some epochs. The amplitude of the variability is quite large. Other epochs, it almost goes away as all the modes cancel out. So this is what Alice's power spectrum looks like. And you can see that the peaks in the power spectrum follow a sort of regular spacing. And in fact, these dotted lines indicate, these dotted lines are placed at a uniform period spacing. You can see that a lot of the peaks line up with the dotted lines. So we've got a regular spacing in period for the modes that we observe, or some of the modes we observe in Alice. This is actually a plot of mode period spacing between consecutive modes as a function of period. So we see a relatively uniform period spacing in the star, and we don't see that much structure in the period space. It's more or less flat. There isn't that sort of regular modulation that we see. That tells us, just by eyeballing this, that Alice has to be a young SBB star.
But isn't the flatness depends on how you zoom in? If you plot the same from 5,000 to 6,000, it will look not that flat.
But the magnitude of the modulations you expect to see would be much larger than what you see here. There's a little bit of modulation, but it's not nearly at the level you would expect from an evolved star.
So, or it means mixing in the models is underestimated. If you have a lot of mixing near the boundary and you smooth out that front peak, presumably it looks more like this.
That's right.
Keep it fully mixed.
So, since Bill's here, there's a quick plug.
So, Rich, before you go on, I just wanted to follow up on Elliot's question there. Just what is the trade-off then between the chemical, composition and the age, or the mixing and the age?
So you can break those degeneracies if you measure the period spacing and the surface properties of the star and some other things. So if you basically get a constraint on both its age and the lack of...
Mm-hmm. So you need some other metric for the age.
I don't know about that, actually.
Also, if you're lucky, you might get modes of different harmonic degrees, which will give you sort of different... They have different degeneracies between age and chemical composition.
What is the error on the age for Alice?
I don't know. I've got a slide in a moment that gives you the age, but it doesn't have an error bar on it.
Okay.
But there's also a reference to the paper by Peter Pavich, where you can look that up. I recall it not being nearly as small as the error bar on ages that you see for RGB stars. Okay. So there is a certain amount of degeneracy there, but it's not terrible. For doing astroseismology, which is where we guess what the oscillation spectrum of a star might look like given a stellar structure and compare that to observations, we need both a stellar evolution code and an oscillation code. So the stuff I'm going to show on subsequent slides uses MESA, which is the open source stellar evolution code developed by Bill and others here at Santa Barbara, and then the oscillation code being used is my Gaia code. Okay, so if you haven't heard of MESA and Gaia, those are what these papers have used. So in modeling Alice, Peter Pavich created a large grid of MESA models and then calculated oscillation frequencies using Gaia and got out these values. And so you can see that there are no error bars. That's very naughty of me. I'm a theorist. the one number to look at is the core hydrogen abundance, which you can see this star started off at 0.7. So this star has only burned a small amount of its core hydrogen. So yes, indeed, this star is young. These two numbers are also of interest. This is the overshoots parameter. This is exponential overshoot. So this is not a standard step overshoot number. The two can be sort of converted one to the other by multiplying by about a factor of 10 and a bit. In a sort of hand-wavy sense. They also had to include extra diffusion within the radiative envelope to actually match the observations. And so there might be additional diffusive processes going on in the envelopes of SBB stars that we don't know about. This is something we actually see in other in models for other stars. So the most interesting thing about ALICE is that if we look at the peaks in the power spectrum in detail, we notice that they're not single peaks, but they're actually multiplets. So this is a dipole mode, and we can see it's actually split into three components. And this splitting is occurring because the star is slowly rotating, and the Coriolis force associated with that slow rotation lifts the frequency degeneracy with respect to M and causes an equal splitting of the of dipole modes. And this is in complete analogy to the Zeeman effect in atomic physics. What's really cool is modes with different radial orders probe different parts of the star, and the rotation in those different parts of the star is different. So by looking at how the splitting changes from one mode of one radial order to the next radial order to the next, you can, in principle, figure out what the rotation rate is throughout the star. Now, this is a messy process. The error bars are large, but nevertheless, we end up with a picture of a star that is rotating in one direction in the core and in the opposite direction in the envelope.
So where exactly is the y-axis?
The y-axis is in its angular velocity in microhertz. Okay.
And there's a zero?
There is a zero there.
Thank you.
Now, this star is an unusually slowly rotating SBB star. So these are very slow rotation rates. And in fact, in a sense, that's what allows us to do this measurement. Because as soon as you get appreciable rotation,
3 months,
the mode spectrum gets scrambled.
3 months?
Yeah. The problem we face now is that we can't get observations like this with upcoming satellites. Yeah. I mean, Kepler was really unparalleled because of its long-duration observations that allowed us to split these.
What about TESS and the continuous viewing zone?
I think it's going to have something like a quarter of the frequency resolution of Kepler.
Okay, let me be heretic here.
Okay.
You take a step back from that.
Uh-huh.
You join the three modes together. It's going to look like a single mode with a variable amplitude. What tells you that not that is the case instead of that?
You see the splitting for all 50 modes.
Yes.
And this is L equals 1. Is L equals 2 seen for the star or not?
I'm not sure it is.
Okay. So what are you saying?
Yeah, but he sees the splitting different everywhere in the star, so that's the nothing. So what you should do is you take that step back.
Uh-huh.
You combine them, and you see if there are any correlations between you will end up with a single mode with variable power.
Mm-hmm.
If you see any correlations between different stars, like the mode is with power in the outside of the star and without power in the inside of the star, and then it changes.
So do you think this is a misinterpretation of amplitude variations?
Maybe not in this case, but I'm sure in some it is.
I think the smoking gun that this is rotational splitting is you wouldn't, I don't think with just some sort of amplitude variation, you would you necessarily expect three components equally split on either side of the central one?
Can be any. As I say, not necessarily in this case, but I'm very sure that in other stars it has been misinterpreted in that way.
Okay. Well, I'm talking about this star.
Rich, just to clarify about going forward, so what's the issue with TESS? The continuous viewing zone has years of data on the same star, so what's the issue?
I
think it's fine.
Yeah?
It's fine for TESS. For the continuous viewing
zone, okay. It's only like 1 year, right?
Okay.
It might get extended, so maybe it'll be like 2 years.
Yeah.
Three, I don't know.
Well, I'm just going on what I've been told by observers.
Well, they do the North Pole, and then they're going to do the South Pole. So I think I can't remember when they flip.
Right, so I think it's only like a year in the continuous but the mission, there's a good chance it'll get extended as long as everything works.
Yeah. Okay, so maybe things aren't as bad as I've been led to believe.
This is
hard.
The
photometry isn't as good.
The photometry is not as really good, so you have to look at different stars, but it'll probably look at more massive stars.
Exactly. So, okay.
Trade-offs.
Yeah. Okay, so let's look at another star, another Kepler star. This is Bob. Bob shows a period spacing that, as well as having regular features in it, so Bob is somewhat more evolved, the period spacing also decreases as we go to longer and longer period modes. And this actually arises because Bob is a rapidly rotating star. It's probably rotating at about 30% of the critical rate. We've got a reasonably good idea now of how to relate the tilt of period spacings to stellar rotation. So the tilting of period spacings occurs due to two effects. Firstly, the Coriolis force basically confines G-modes to an equatorial waveguide. This is a little animation showing what happens when we switch rotation on. So at first, the pulsation occurs at all latitudes, but then with the Coriolis force, it gets squeezed down to the equator. The Coriolis force actually leads to a modification to our asymptotic formula. We have to replace harmonic degree by an effective harmonic degree that's much larger than it would ordinarily be. And that effective harmonic degree is large because we've squeezed the modes into a small waveguide, so the wave number is large. There's also a Doppler shift transformation between the co-rotating frame and the inertial frame. And taken together, these effects mean that global rotation or uniform rotation will basically tilt, these are models, tilt a period spacing pattern by an amount that depends on the rotation of the star. So whenever we see a tilted period spacing, we can get a rotation rate out pretty much for free. And that's kind of cool. So
those reviewed equator on, that tilt or pull, like I would think that you would have a difference.
It doesn't matter what angle you view this from.
No, but if you're at the pole.
I mean, how is that possible?
Well, no, if you're exactly at the pole, you wouldn't see a damn thing.
Yeah. Right.
That affects the amplitude, but not the frequency.
Okay.
So remember, these diagrams are all based on frequencies. They don't depend on the amplitude of the modes. The visibility of these modes will change as you view at different angles. In fact, with this equatorial confinement, quite counterintuitively, it's more visible from near the pole than near the equator. Because when you see it near the pole, you actually it changes the projected area of the star in the sky. If you see it exactly from the pole, then all bets are off. There's no variability. But from near the pole, the amplitude is actually larger.
So do you have an independent measurement of the rotation from rotational splitting as well?
These stars are rotating so rapidly that the nice sort of linear splitting you expect that we saw in ALICE breaks down completely. So a good analogy, again, with quantum mechanics is as you ramp up the field strength, all of the nice structure you see in the Zeeman effect goes away. You go through a sort of transition, sort of intermediate field case, and then in the very strong field limit, you end up with a pattern back effect. And there's an analogous set of strong field limits that Lars originally derived for very rapid rotation that tells you what the regularity in the splitting should be. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, stars usually aren't in that very, very strong splitting limit. They're kind of in the intermediate case where you can only get out numerical results, and also there aren't really regularities in the frequency or period spectrum for you to pick out nice patterns. So things get kind of messy. And certainly a lot messier than, as is the case with ALICE, where you can see that lovely splitting.
So Rich, where is the transition between, what rotation fraction of critical is the transition between the linear?
It actually depends not on the fraction of critical, but on the ratio of the the rotation frequency and the oscillation frequency. So when 2 times big omega over little omega, so the so-called spin parameter, when that goes above 1, you're in the Coriolis-dominated regime, and that's when things start. That's when things are switching over. Okay. So even if a star is notionally slowly rotating, let's say at 5% of critical, if you find a mode excited that has a low enough frequency, that mode can nevertheless be strongly affected by rotation. So whether a star is fast or slow rotating with respect to oscillations actually depends on what modes you're talking about. You can't make that judgment just based on the strength of the centrifugal force. Elliot, did you have another question? Okay. Right. So these are the five SBB stars from Peter Papich's 2017 paper. Here is Alice. So the period spacing is almost completely flat. That's because, as I said, it's a very slow rotator. This is Bob, I think. And then this is going to even more rapidly rotating stars. So this gives you an idea of the rotation frequency in cycles per day. And as you can see, this star, well, in fact, these two stars have rotation periods of less than a day. So these are very rapidly rotating stars indeed.
So for these rapidly rotating stars, to what extent can you have the same scenario as for Alice, where different portions of the envelope can actually be rotating at very different frequencies, in fact, counter-rotating?
It's completely possible, but being able to disentangle, we've been able to dig out some modes from the let me answer that again. I think the problem comes because as you go to these very high rotation rates, your stellar model, your 1D stellar model, becomes less and less reliable. And so I think any conclusions you draw about the internal rotation of the star become more and more shaky. Having said that, as I will show in a slide or two, there are a number of oscillating massive stars for which a core envelope dichotomy in the rotation has been demonstrated. And we're talking a difference in the core rotation rate or near core rotation rate and the outer envelope rotation rate, a difference of at least 30% or more. So we can get inklings that there is internal cellular differential rotation going on in these stars, but our models are insufficient to actually make a measurement of what that rotation profile looks like in detail, because these stars are so rapidly rotating, our understanding of the actual basic stellar structure is inadequate.
So if not talking about internal structure, can you find the rotation profile as a function of latitude?
That's something that has been occasionally looked for observationally by looking at the shapes of line profiles.
Repeat the question, sorry, I couldn't hear.
Can you infer anything about latitudinal variation in the rotation rate? So a few people have looked for observationally, looking for pole to equator differences in the angular velocity from the line profiles, but I don't think it's ever evident. I don't think evidence has ever been found that demonstrates or overturns the notion that the surface is rotating solidly. More generally, I think the community as a whole seems to be quite happy with the cellular rotation paradigm that really goes back to Jean-Paul Zahn's 92 paper, arguing that strong horizontal turbulence will tend to keep the angular velocity constant on shells of fixed radius. And really, that is the current paradigm for all quasi-1D stellar evolution codes.
I know about the paradigm. Interested about the
observations. I don't think, given that the stellar models don't go beyond a cellular rotation paradigm, that there's nothing we can infer from Ford modeling that isn't already in the stellar models. We can't say anything about latitudinal differential rotation if there's nothing about that in the stellar models. So we are limited in Ford modeling to whatever's in the stellar models, and we simply lack the data for reverse modeling or inversion.
Yeah, I think at slow rotation you could any rotation profile.
You detected different L's, different L modes, and detected different frequency spacings. In principle, you could get a handle on the latitudinal differential rotation, but actually detecting all those modes in a star that's well-behaved where you understand everything that you're seeing and you can put that into your stellar model and get a result, I don't think that's ever been done. But I think in principle it's possible.
I think it's, I mean, you fundamentally you need your stellar model has to be able to simulate.
Well, you can make a 1D model and add whatever rotation profile you want as a function of radius or as a function of latitude. And then you can calculate modes on top of that model.
I mean, I guess the way to figure it, which is, we know we can do it for the sun, The sun's close.
Yeah, but also the sun uses helioseismic inversion.
I understand. That's in some sense what Jim's proposing.
Now, I mean, I know there are 2D models for stars. They're not evolutionary models. They're structure models only. But yeah, I guess I could imagine, you know, some of the stuff that Bob Dupree has done. And also, I guess the Toulouse people have got some 2D models for massive star envelopes. So yeah, I guess in principle, you could do latitudinal variations. But again, these are structure models, they're not evolutionary models. And what these models might get right in terms of the latitudinal variation, they get so many other things wrong in terms of stellar astrophysics that I don't know.
So, but does it mean that, you know, for now, if you have spectral observations that tell you that the surface of the star is appearing to be slowly rotating, you don't know actually what the rotation of the bulk is, and vice versa?
I would completely agree with. And in fact, I'm going to show you a couple of slides in a moment that gives one possible way in which that might occur. In fact, it turns out that the thing that we're using to infer this differential rotation, the oscillations, could actually be causing it. So, with Bob, Ihsan Moravegi did some models of Bob. The best fit model has, again, some overshooting, some diffusive mixing, rotation a little over a quarter of critical. What's interesting about this paper is that Ihsan assumed two different overshoot profiles, where one the exponential overshoot and one step overshoot, and they actually lead to different shapes for the Brunt-Weissler frequency near the core boundary. He was able to show that the exponential overshoot gives a better fit to the observations than the step overshoot. This is one of the first papers actually realizing the promise of astroseismology and actually nailing down what the correct physics is. Admittedly doing it in an empirical way rather than a first principles way, but nevertheless, it's a pretty cool result. And as you can see, the model doesn't do too bad a job of reproducing at least the bulk of the modulations, although we're not quite here, and we're not quite right here.
Rich, just a quick comment on this mixing on the radiative envelope.
Uh-huh.
That's tiny. So, I mean, that's literally just mixing a bit above the overshooting region or close to your convective boundaries.
Uh-huh.
If you turn off that for most of the structure of the radiative envelope, the mole will end up being the same. I mean, that only has effects on tiny.
But what you've got to remember is that this structure in the period spacing is really being determined by what's going on at that core boundary.
Yes, but I'm saying that that's not evidence that there's any mixing throughout the radiative envelope of any kind. That's tiny mixing that only slightly smooths out this inner region.
So what you're saying is maybe a better prescription of the overshoot would actually do that as well.
Yeah, this reads more like an overshooting limitation.
Okay. Okay.
I'm happy with that.
Okay, so looking to the future observationally, K2 can't point at a star for as long as we'd like, even though it can point at stars we'd like it to point at. I was informed that TESS was going to have lower frequency resolution. It seems that's not a problem. However, there obviously are the continuous viewing zone restrictions. Gaia, just, you know, the data are insufficient for doing any kind of astroseismology. Bright's doing some really interesting stuff with massive stars, because it only looks at bright stars, and massive stars are also bright stars, but its signal-to-noise is quite low. So Plato is probably going to be the next really big thing. Having said that, though, you know, there are still data in the Kepler archives that we've yet to pull stuff out of, so there's still plenty of observations to keep the modelers busy.
But Richard, for pointing, I mean, so let's go back to K2. So if you look at, go back to Alice or Bob or one of these, where you had everybody. Forward.
You want Bob?
No, where you had four different ones, all five were on.
Yeah, that's where I was going back to. There we go.
Okay, so this span is, this is 100 days. So that's K2.
Can K2?
Almost, 80 days.
Right. I think it's marginal, isn't it?
No, but it'll get the modes.
Will it?
Well, the rotation might be a change.
Okay.
I think those FFTs are the whole data set, though.
No, I understand, but I'm just saying that.
Oh, yeah. No, the FFTs are the whole.
Sure, but there's real content just in. I mean, somebody's doing this, right? They're doing SVB stars in K2.
Oh, no, sure they are. But what I'm saying is to get out results comparable to these, K2's not going to cut the mustard, okay? So, I mean, as Jim has pointed out...
Which one is K2?
It is the continuation of Kepler without the reaction wheel, so using solar wind pressure to stabilize it. Yep, it's pretty crazy.
Crutches. That's fine. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so, I mean, as Jim pointed out, those light curves you saw in that image are not the full data stream.
I
understand. So...
I think Horace was just saying that there's structure on the time scale on which you are actually getting K2 observations. So it's radier, but if you let...
Yeah, no, there's still science that can be done. What I'm saying is...
You're spoiled, right?
Kepler has just, you know, blown us away. And now we've got to live on, you know, we've got to ration our food for 10 years. Okay, so to finish up, I'm going to put up a few slides about something I've been working on recently, the question of whether stellar oscillations can drive differential rotation. So there are a few massive stars that seem to show... different core, and when I say core, I really mean near core. Different core envelope differential, different core envelope rotation, and so you know some evidence for a differential rotation existing. So we can model this, the effects of pulsation modes themselves on the differential rotation of a star by writing down an equation governing wave transport of angular momentum. So the torque per unit volume applied by a pulsation mode. Is going to consist of a divergence of a wave flux, so angular momentum extraction and deposition due to wave excitation or dissipation. And this is what the angular momentum flux actually looks like. So there's a Reynolds stress term. This actually is going to be cancelled out by... This is a Stokes current term, and Jim has argued that that goes away. This is a third-order term we don't need to worry about. So basically, this is a Reynolds stress term. There's angular momentum actually stored in the wave, and then there's a gravitational torque. As the oscillation mode changes the mass distribution in the star, then that perturbed mass distribution exerts a gravitational torque on other parts of the star. So we can evaluate this expression if we have an idea of what velocity, density, and gravitational potential perturbations look like in an oscillating star.
Just one question on notation. What's the difference between a bar and an angle bracket?
So bar are azimuthal averages, angle brackets are polar averages.
Got it.
Okay?
Yeah.
And pomega, as my math teacher used to call it, I think people who were trained at Cambridge called it pomega. So you know someone's from Cambridge when they call it, except he was from Belfast, so it was pomega! So my math teacher called it, yeah, that's r sine theta. That's the distance from the axis. Okay, so...
And what can cause counter-rotation like analysis?
We'll see.
It's coming up.
It's coming up. Wait for it. It's a great build-up here. Okay, so in the literature, there has been some interest in angular momentum transport by G-modes. G-modes are most effective at angular momentum transport because the fluid motions are predominantly horizontal. P-modes aren't really good at carrying angular momentum. So... there's been some work by Tammy Rogers doing anelastic hydrosims of G-modes excited at the convective core boundary and then propagating throughout the star and carrying angular momentum with them. These sims are the only sort of dynamical simulations done to date. Well, actually, there have been a few, I guess, done also using the ASH code. But in order to get surface velocity amplitudes that she thought were reasonable, Tammy really had to overdrive the convection hugely because her code has got a Reynolds number that's far, far smaller than it really should be, so there's too much dissipation in there. So she had to overdrive the convection to actually get an appreciable flux of angular momentum getting out to the surface. And so I'm not sure, I mean, Tammy's going to be here later on in the program. I look forward to talking to her about that.
I think very significantly overestimate the amplitudes and angular momentum transfer.
Yeah, I'm not sure. So there have been other attempts to simulate angular momentum transport by stochastic modes. Lee Mathis and Nina did some simulations of this BE star that they have that Coralie claims to have seen stochastic modes in. And then Jim's done some sort of heuristic models. I'm not meaning heuristic pejoratively, Jim, but I wasn't quite sure how to label them.
Yeah, they're very approximate.
They're just thinking sort of in a Gedanken experiment sort of way about... So Jim's focus was really on later stage stuff, though, wasn't it? And then I know Elliot's done some work on thinking about wave transport phenomena near core collapse and things like that. But what I've been working on recently with Jacqueline Goldstein, who's going to be joining me later on the program, she's my grad student, Ellen Zweibel back at UW-Madison, is wondering whether the Kappa mechanism-driven modes that are present in massive stars. So every single massive star at some point in its lifetime, before it, as it evolves across the main sequence, it has to pass through one or more instability strips. So it is going to go through a phase where there are these heat-driven oscillations. And the question is, can G-modes excited by the Kappa mechanism drive angular momentum transport? In our study, we've mainly focused on SBB stars, but our results should generalize to the higher mass G-mode pulsators, the pulsating blue supergiants. So this is a little simulation we did where we took a single mode of a 4.21 stellar mass SBB model. We normalized the amplitude of the mode to match the typical amplitudes that we observe in pulsating in SBB stars. So because we're using linear theory, we can't predict what the amplitude will be, so we just fix it based on empirical constraints. And then we take the torque that will be generated by this mode and put it back into MESA as an additional torque on the stellar structure and evolve the star for 1,000 years. So during that 1,000 years, we've got the torque from the mode, which we assume is fixed, and then we've got the torques that are generated from all of the shear instabilities, the Solberg-Hoyland instability, the GSF instability, all of that lot. Not the Taylor-Sprout, though. I'll discuss Taylor-Sprout in a moment.
So okay. What's the amplitude, of the mode?
The mode has a radial... the radial displacement amplitude is 0.4% at the surface.
This is normal, some observationally motivated?
That's basically the typical amplitude that was measured in a systematic mode analysis done by Yagoda, Dzinska, Daskiewicz in 2015. Okay, so let's start the simulation.
Question, Rich. So you have plus or minus M.
Yep.
So what do you do?
So I'm assuming a prograde mode. The star starts off non-rotating.
Okay. So it excites both equally, I would assume.
No, I'm just putting one in.
But shouldn't it excite both equally?
It doesn't.
A real star is going to be rotating, and that rotation, the Coriolis force, breaks the symmetry.
Okay.
But I've started off with a non-rotating star, and I'm just using modeler's privilege to choose just a prograde mode. If I'd done a retrograde mode, the results would look almost the same, except the sign of the results change. So, so this is time here, and this is angular velocity. So this sort of partially answers Ilya's question. Okay, so 1,000 years of evolution. Starting from a completely non-rotating star, the surface has been spun in one direction, and the outer part, or the bit below the surface, has been spun in the opposite direction. The total angular momentum of the star is still zero. So on average, the star is still non-rotating, but it has a surface layer that's counter-rotating with respect to the interior. The reason why the surface layer gets spun in this direction is that the mode is being excited in the iron bump zone, which is at a fractional radius of about here. That mode, because it's going in the prograde direction, causes the surface layers to recoil in the retrograde direction, and then that mode dumps its energy in the radiative damping zone here. There's also a small amount of energy being, or angular momentum being dumped in the molecular weight gradient zone. This mode is really able to overcome all of the other angular momentum transport processes, meridional circulation, all the shear instabilities, all of that, and establish a steep shear layer separating the surface from the interior. This rotation rate is about a third of critical at the surface. Okay, 1,000 years, a third of critical. Wow. Okay. So let's look at this across the SBB instability strip.
Convection zone.
Sorry?
Convection zone with sides relative to on your last. There's a core convection.
Yes. I can show you where it is.
I'm just curious about how far it went out.
You start with zero rotation and end up with 30 degrees. I'm sure that all the stars in the data are almost like 30. It's just like a little bit too much for me.
Yeah. this result is almost surely wrong. But someone has to tell me why it's wrong.
Where did it go wrong?
I've put in enough physics to break the universe, and we need to put in more physics to fix it again. Okay? So this is a mode excited at the amplitudes we see in these stars. So why isn't this happening? Okay? Or if it is happening, doesn't it mean that all of our measurements of surface rotation rates are giving us no idea at all about what the star's doing in its interior? Yeah. And all stars must pass, all massive stars must go through an instability strip like this.
Exciting the frequency is one thing, but how much energy you put in that excitement is another.
He's saying he's normalizing the amplitude to measured amplitude.
Yeah.
He's basically saying that the potentially spectral observations have absolutely tell us no story about the evolutionary history, right? If you want to, you can infer
that was just
problem.
One of the branches.
Okay, so let me show one more slide, and then we can talk about some caveats, okay? Okay, so this is from doing the simulation for a whole set of models that pave the SBB instability strip. So each circle is a model, and the filled circles are stars which have one or more unstable modes. They mark out the instability strips for L equals 1 and L equals 2 modes, and they're colored according to the surface velocity reached after 1,000 years of transport by a single G-mode. And you can see the velocities are getting up to be towards 100 kilometers a second, okay? And these are all normalized in the same way, based on observations. So there's obviously something very funny going on here.
Rich, what's the mass coordinate above this location?
Probably quite small.
I was just worried about mass loss on the main sequence.
Not for these stars.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You're not 3 or 4.
No, these stars don't have winds. They're too wimpy. I mean, maybe, you know, up at 25, that might be important, yeah. But for down at this lower mass end, not important. Okay, so let's try and think of a way out.
Are you sure you don't lose that mass coordinate in 1,000 years?
Absolutely.
That's what I was asking about the mass coordinate.
Well, we're talking 0.1, 0.01.
Oh, okay, fine.
Yeah, yeah. You know, 1%. to place these numbers into context, so let's first of all place this notional 1,000 years into context. These circles representing my models span around 3 million years of stellar evolution. So in each of these stars, if we just excited one mode, that one mode would spin the surface up to very, very rapid rotation, almost instantaneously. Okay, and there really is no way out of that. Except, okay, one thing we can do is we can say, okay, Rich, what happens when you turn on the Taylor Sprute dynamo? Okay? So this is a controversial field generation dynamo that works in radiative zones based on the Taylor instability, amplifying converting the toroidal magnetic field into poloidal, and then the poloidal field getting sheared by differential rotation. If I put in the Taylor-Sprute instability, the whole effect is quenched, okay? Because the coupling, the angular momentum coupling that tends to enforce solid body rotation is stronger than the mode can ever be counteracted by the mode. So we can get rid of this by putting in Taylor-Sprute. So one thing this might be telling us is that, yeah, Taylor-Sprute's a real thing. We have to put it in, otherwise this crazy shit happens. Another thing it could be telling us is, well, you know, I put in a single mode. In fact, there are going to be many modes simultaneously excited. That's what we see in the observation. And they're all going to fight amongst each other. And things are going to be a little bit more complicated than I've shown. But, in fact, we don't even have to do that make this effect somewhat different. If we consider just one mode, as soon as a differential rotation profile is established by the mode, that differential rotation will actually change the way the mode behaves in the star. That's something I haven't got in my simulations. That's the next step for me, is to actually put in the feedback effect of the differential rotation coming from the mode on the mode excitation and the places where the mode pulls up angular momentum and deposits it. But certainly, this is one of those situations where we have to put in more physics to prevent bad things from happening, rather than, because the physics we put in so far is on very, very firm theoretical, on a very firm theoretical basis, so we can't just wave it away. We've got to put in more physics to make the bad thing not happen.
So just to clarify, so that's all assuming this is wrong. So what is the empirical evidence that this is wrong?
There is none.
Okay. I mean, those measurements of the delta P as a function of P, which show that inclines slopes, isn't that some average interior rotation?
That is kind of some average interior rotation.
I would assume that would sort of argue against this picture that it's all confined to a thin mass coordinate.
Well, so what you have to remember is that I started off with a non-rotating star. Had I started off with a rotating star, whatever the mode did would be superimposed on that initial angular momentum distribution. Also, the initial rotation would itself have modified the way the mode behaves, right from the beginning. So things are going to look somewhat different in a star that's already rotating, but not, I imagine, by a huge amount.
What does define how deeply the calculation? Because Alice was about 26 over.
So the interesting thing about Alice is that the there is counter rotation, but overall it's so very, very modest. The counter rotation in Alice, or the overall modulus of the rotation angular frequency in Alice, is just a tiny fraction of critical. So Alice shows counter rotation, but it's intrinsically a very, very slow rotator.
But the place where you start this counter rotation. Will be defined by the same mechanism as you found. It's just that the amplitude
One thing worth bearing in mind, though, is as I run this simulation, there's actually a rather than the shear layer being completely fixed, there's a front that propagates inwards. The rate at which it propagates inwards gets slower and slower, but I stop it after 1,000 years, but it doesn't actually reach a steady state. It just keeps on going inwards. Okay, it'll go slower and slower, but it'll keep on creeping inwards. Now, in a real star, of course, the star's also doing other evolutionary things, and some of those other evolutionary things are changing the structure of the star, and that's going to change which modes are excited, and also, you know, it might steal energy from the mode. So, over long timescales, I don't really want to say that front will keep on going inwards forever. Other things will change in the meantime. But nevertheless, I think this is an interesting result. So I'm going to finish up with a very, very sort of semi-final slide, reminding everybody that all stars are binaries, even the ones that aren't. And if we have eccentric binaries, as well as showing regular sorts of tidal behavior, they also show dynamical tides. So these are the excitation of, or forced excitation of, one or more of the star's oscillation modes. This is from an embargoed paper by Bert Pablo. I'm not telling you what the star is, because it's embargoed. But this is a massive star binary, which, as well as showing the sort of signature of the ellipsoidal variations, the static tide at periastron, if you look at the light curve closely, you can actually see periodic variability, which is forced excitation of the star's oscillation mode. So this is an example of a heartbeat star where you see both the static and dynamic tides.
Can you tell us how massive the star is?
I would hazard masses based on the spectral type of 15 to 20-ish.
I think it's roughly 10.
20 and 10. 20
and
10?
Okay.
Something like that.
Are you on?
Yeah.
Okay. So Jim gave me this.
Okay.
I did have the name of the star, but I took it off. Okay. So, summary. Massive stars oscillate in heat-driven and possibly stochastic modes. With modern instrumentation, we can actually do astroseismology. I couldn't say the same thing maybe 5 or 10 years ago. You can say that now. And oscillations may have an important feedback on the stellar structure that we ignore at our peril. Okay? I think you've already asked all the questions.
I'm actually just curious about this starting it without rotation. It seems hard to believe that you seem to think that if you actually did have a rotational profile in the star, that it wouldn't actually change the results that much. But that seems counterintuitive, just because it seems like you would have to kind of overcome that rotation to grow the other.
Well, remember initially, if the rotation profile is initially flat, all of the mechanisms that tend to fight against the wave transport are...
do you expect it to be flat? I mean, I guess...
It really depends on what physics you put in.
When you run this model next, are you putting in a flat rotation frequency?
Unless, it's this mode frequency versus rotation frequency. Unless the mode frequency, the rotation frequency is actually larger than the mode frequency of the mode you're trying to excite, it won't have a huge
effect. Yeah, I mean, so we have the ability to do the simulations with rotation. So while I'm here, that's one thing I'm going to be working on.
Update in 3 months.
Yeah.
But even in that limit, basically all that same physics can occur. Even on a
rotation. Probably it may not counter rotate, right?
Well, that's what I'm wondering.
I'm not sure you would necessarily get counter rotation, but you would get differential rotation.
Yeah, that's the point that I'm trying to,
So the thing worth remembering about the 1SBB star that has counter rotation has almost no angular momentum to begin with. It may be only those stars that are born with a deficit of angular momentum are the ones that show counter rotation.
Yeah.
Whereas the ones that are born with a nice bias, an initial bias to the rotation, they won't show counter rotation, but they'll still show differential rotation.
Right. So it's the counter rotating bump that I feel like intuitively that seems like it'd be hard to grow if you started with.
And I think that star Alice is a good evidence that this process does not happen to the extent that these simulations show, because that one is not rotating in a third of breakup.
What is the total sample size, though? Like, so you showed 5 stars, very stars. Beautiful, right? But I mean,
15. There are 15 Kepler SBBs.
15 total, yeah. And in K2, presumably with modulo, these issues of shorter.
I have no idea.
Those are still being worked on, I think.
Okay, but the statistics are crappy.
Yeah.
It
could be interesting to do a plus or minus n pair.
Yeah, so back in the noughties, I think 2007, I did some simulations where I had multiple modes simultaneously excited, and I allowed their amplitudes to actually grow or decay according to their linear growth rates. And you could see prograde and retrograde pairs fighting it out. But for this one, I think, because this is kind of a controversial idea, I thought it'd be better to use just observational constraints to set the amplitudes.
So one of the other questions would be, so if you have stars that are being spun down by wind magnetic braking or even just wind mass loss,
mm-hmm.
are there options for this kind of mechanism for helping to decide how much that transports the loss of angular momentum from the surface down into the star?
Well, unless the star's pulsating,
it won't do anything. Obviously.
Well, yeah, I mean, you need pulse, but I mean the that aside, it's a very interesting question of when a star is being spun down by magnetic braking, where exactly is the angular momentum being robbed from? And it's not clear when one's doing, let's say, Mesa models of this, where to steal the angular momentum from. I know Jolt is working on this. Jolt. I can't remember. I can't pronounce his last name. It's Greg Wade's grad student. He's the one who worked with Vero on the magnetic progenitors to black holes.
Yeah, I'm right.
Okay, folks.
Brilliant start.